You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Thursday, October 7th, 2021. My name is Emma Figland in for Sam Steeder, and this is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Alex Hockley, jeez, author of When Sam's Not Here, I Gotta Do It, author of The End of the End of History, Politics in the 21st Century. Meanwhile, McConnell finally blinked. He agreed to a deal on a short-term lifting of the debt limit with Senate Majority Leader Schumer through December 3rd, delaying an economic catastrophe and a needless fight over an artificial debt ceiling for a few weeks. GOP donors got restless, I'd imagine. A federal judge appointed by Obama has ordered Texas to suspend its near entire abortion ban in a scathing 113-page opinion. Texas, however, vowed to immediately appeal the ruling because, of course. Also in Texas, there was a school shooting outside of Dallas yesterday, and thus far, four people have been injured, with one in critical condition. The 18-year-old suspect has also been taken into custody. The WHO is celebrating the historic development of the first-ever malaria vaccine. Malaria kills 500,000 people every year. Almost half of those are children in the continent of Africa. The vaccine is the first developed for any parasitic disease, which is more complex than, say, viral or bacterial infection. So this is a massive victory. In heartbreaking news, over 120,000 U.S. children have lost a caregiver to the pandemic, meaning the number of orphans to come out of COVID is higher than previously thought, and over half of these children are Hispanic or Black, a disproportionate representation based on population. A new report indicates that the Biden administration knew thousands of Haitian migrants were preparing to seek asylum in the U.S. They knew in July, so they can no longer hide behind the "we were unprepared" defense. And lastly, Minneapolis police body cam footage shows cops joking about hunting protesters in the wake of George Floyd's murder, fist bumping as they shot rubber bullets at them and encouraging the gassing of demonstrators as well. All this and more on today's program. Welcome to the show, everyone. We have a great show for you. Sam is out, as he is every Thursday these days, and actually I will be out tomorrow. I am off, doing a little bit of celebrating, so I won't be in, and soak me up while you can today on this lovely Thursday. We have averted an economic catastrophe, as I mentioned, with McConnell for the first time that I can remember buckling a little bit, showing a minute sign of weakness. He wasn't willing to tank the entire global economy just in order to obstruct Biden's agenda immediately. He's just putting that off until December. We won't know how that's going to play out for a few weeks at this point, but it does buy Chuck Schumer and the Democrats some time as they're also juggling this reconciliation process. Now, speaking of the reconciliation process and the Build Back Better agenda, Joe Manchin, he is one of the two U.S. senators holding up the entire Biden agenda, which has already been whittled down. We should point out the Build Back Better infrastructure plan was initially around $6 to $7 trillion over 10 years, as imagined by Senate Budget Chair Bernie Sanders, who we'll be speaking about in a bit. But Joe Manchin now, even though the initial figure was decided as $3.5 trillion, which we're not going to get anyway, that was the compromise coming out of the Senate budget process, Manchin still wants it whittled down to around $1.5 trillion over 10 years, which is very, very small comparatively to what was initially imagined. And he spoke to the media yesterday because the sun rises in the east and sets in the west. But frankly, it is a lesser evil in comparison to cinema, who hides from her constituents and from the media. Regardless, Manchin spoke about why he wants to cut down Biden's Build Back Better agenda to a fraction of what it was initially supposed to be. Here he is speaking to the press.
So I've been very clear when it comes to who we are as a society, who we are as a nation, and why we are still the hope of the world. I don't believe that we should turn our society into an entitlement society. I think that we should still be a compassionate, rewarding society. I think that fares best for all of us. But compassion means taking care of those who can't take care of themselves, whether they're young, whether they've had some type of a challenge in life, whether it be mental or physical. Those are responsibilities that we have, and we can all meet those responsibilities. And I feel very strongly about that. And we will continue. This is going to take time to get this done. Getting it done quickly is not going to benefit anybody. So let's make sure that we do it and do it right.
So there's a lot there. But let me just mention entitlement in reference to Joe Manchin. You know, I'd say there's a little bit of entitlement in, I guess, collecting checks from a coal company, or at least making a bunch of money from a coal company in your state as you make a six-figure salary as one of the 100 most powerful people in the country as a part of the United States Senate, and as you preside over the Senate Energy and Natural Resources Committee. Huh? But who's to say? When you're rich, entitlement is foundational. When you're poor, entitlement is a moral failing. And
corporations are entitled to an impoverished and undereducated workforce. Basically, is what that's the big entitlement in America is. Joe Manchin's coal companies have workforces that need to go work for those coal companies because they need health care, and they need and they're not given wage, and they're given wages that aren't able for them to move and advance beyond that. They're like, this is captivity.
And that's why he also mentions the phrase, or uses the word, rewarding. A rewarding society. That's the operative word here. Take out compassion, because it can literally mean anything. We know this from decades of usage of the concept of compassionate conservatism. And we know that conservative ideology is incompatible with compassion. He mentions rewarding because of that same disciplinary attitude. Yeah. Right? We are going to reward you for being a obedient worker and participating in the workforce on the conditions that we set for you.
Yeah, feudal plantation, whatever like sort of mindset you want to put this in.
Exactly. So that's why it's important for the left to reset the conversation, not around buzzwords like compassion, but around policy sets, and say what you're going to do for people. And that's exactly what Senate Budget Chair Bernie Sanders did yesterday in response to that comment by Joe Manchin.
Now, Senator Manchin, as I understand it, talked about today about not wanting to see our country become an entitlement society. Well, I am not exactly sure what he means by that. Does that mean that we end the $300 direct payments for working class parents, which have cut childhood poverty in this country as a result of the American Rescue Plan, in half? Is protecting working families and cutting childhood poverty an entitlement? Does Senator Manchin think we should once again have one of the highest levels of childhood poverty of any major country on earth?
That's the point, right? That's the point. Manchin defines entitlements, or these things, as entitlements, which are in Build Back Better. Universal pre-K, those toddlers, those kids are so entitled. Medicare expansion, dental, hearing, and vision, and that. An extension of the child tax credit, which Bernie talked about how it did alleviate poverty. Paid family and medical leave. These are things that he claims are entitlements. And that's what the focus needs to be.
But Joe Manchin's daughter is entitled to jack up the prices of EpiPens and make people buy two of them because she's the CEO of a company that she rose to that position lying about her business degree, and which she was also entitled to West Virginia University covering up that she lied about that while her dad was a governor. So that's entitlements. Interesting who gets entitled to what in this country.
Right. And what is defined as an entitlement versus just basic humanity. I also want to note that Bernie's being based all over the place over the past 48 hours. He also declined to sign on to Cory Booker's letter to condemn the protesters in Arizona who spoke to Cinnamon in the bathroom, because the bathroom is a sacred place.
As Ben Shapiro will tell us later.
Yes. Ben Shapiro gets very uncomfortable when you mention the bathroom. Bernie really, I think, is the only notable progressive senator to not sign on to this, and his office declined to comment to Axios, which I love. Elizabeth Warren signed on. Cory Booker obviously spearheaded this effort. Bernie Sanders understands that this is righteous anger that protesters are directing at Sinema and Manchin as well. And this is going to be the consequence if you stand in the way of legislation that helps people. You're not going to be comfortable in the streets and in the bathroom and on your yacht. That's not going to be the case. And so keep the pressure up, because we've got, at the very least, one person in the Senate who understands. And luckily for us, he's got a pretty powerful position as budget chair. And so hopefully he'll continue to hold the line. We have to take a quick break, but when we come back, we will be joined by Alex Hochuli. Hochuli. Man, I wrote down like Kathy Hochul, and that's not true, so that's what's throwing me off. Author of The End of History, Politics in the 21st Century. I'm so sorry, Alex. Sam, take it away.
Thank you, Emma. Hey, today's sponsor is BetterHelp Online Counseling. They're giving our audience 10% off their first month when you go to betterhelp.com/majority report. BetterHelp gives you access to your own fully licensed and accredited therapist via phone, chat, or video. Now, I'm sure you're aware, if you've attempted to go see a therapist, therapists elsewhere have long wait lists. Sometimes it can take you weeks. Sometimes it can take you months before they can see you. But when you sign up with BetterHelp, they match you with a therapist based on your specific needs, and you'll be communicating with them in less than 24 hours. A lot of people found telemedicine to be very helpful, particularly therapy during COVID. And I suspect there's a lot of folks who are just going to stick with that. I found it much more convenient. Obviously, a lot of stress coming out of a pandemic, a lot of stress during a pandemic, a lot of stress when there's not a pandemic. Therapy has been extremely helpful for me. It's always helpful to speak to someone. And once BetterHelp connects you with a therapist, if you find that it's not a good fit, you can switch to a new one at any time for any reason with no additional charge. They have thousands of licensed therapists from all over the country, so they have therapists with specialties that may not even be available in your area. BetterHelp also tends to be more affordable than therapists that you'd find through traditional means. You don't have to have insurance to use BetterHelp, and they have financial aid options for those who qualify. BetterHelp is giving everyone in our audience 10% off your first month when you go to betterhelp.com/majority report. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P, betterhelp.com/majority report. You can find the URL in the description of this video or podcast, and check it out.
We are back. And we are joined now by Alex Hochuli, author of The End of History, Politics in the 21st Century. Alex, thank you so much for your time today.
Well, thanks for having me on. Delighted to be here.
I'm really excited to talk with you about this, because I love some of these existential questions about the tides of politics, which your book certainly grapples with, this like very uneasy and turbulent time that we're all experiencing. where the neoliberal ruling class has been dealt a lot of blows. And then we're also seeing the rise of authoritarian right-wing populism. And like in the book, you'll also talk about the show Jackass, but then also in the same breath, we're talking about Brazilian politics and the collapse of the Soviet Union, I guess. So maybe we can just start from the widest focus and then move inward.
Right. Well, I mean, I think you summed it up well that we live in confusing times. And it's quite obvious that sometime around maybe 5 years ago, something changed, or at least people started becoming conscious of the fact that something had changed, that the way that we thought politics worked no longer seemed to work anymore. And as a consequence, you know, you had people reaching for all these sorts of crazy analogies of where we are today, right? So people, I think in the US, we're talking about whether this is a repeat of Weimar Germany, you know, the Nazis are coming, or maybe if they're a bit more sophisticated, start talking about Mussolini, maybe Trump was actually Mussolini. Or, you know, I even saw mentions of that the US is about to live through its years of lead, which is a reference to the 1970s in Italy, or, you know, a new civil war, things like this. And I think that all testifies to the fact that because these interpretive frames obviously don't apply to today, that there's a great deal of confusion. And if you look at maybe smarter books talking about this stuff, they talk about the rise of populism, the end of democracy, the end of liberalism, the end of globalization, maybe even the end of Western civilization. And for all that those elements might have a certain element of truth to them, I think they all miss what is fundamentally going on and what is kind of, well, historically unique about our present moment. And that's the fact that, you know, the period that's just been passed, let's say from 1990 until 2016, democracy wasn't vibrant. So to talk about the end of democracy seems a bit bizarre, as if you're saying that what was the operating mode of politics for the past 30 years was, you know, that everything was hunky-dory and everything worked well. The reality is, and this is why we say it's the end of history, is that the period that has been termed the end of history, the period after the end of the Cold War, the period when liberal democracy was hegemonic, the period in which all big questions about politics were held to be settled, all that remained was to fine-tune the technical implementation. Should we raise interest rates 0.5% or bring them down a bit? All those, that sort of form of a very limited, circumscribed, centrist form of politics, that has suddenly started to fall apart. And it started to fall apart because the legitimacy of ruling classes across on both sides of the Atlantic started to crumble, and it started to crumble because of the delayed consequences of the 2008 global financial crisis.
Yeah, and even before that, right? I mean, I think we can focus on the 2008 global financial crisis in a bit, but I guess I kind of want to start at 1990, and even maybe the presidency of George H.W. Bush, which was, in my mind, and I think you guys in your book, your co-authors and you as well, say this very well, it was this new world order about hegemony, as you mentioned, and submission, which defined Bush's foreign policy. And also there was zero questioning of the neoliberal world order in the wake of the Cold War. The Soviets were defeated, and thus it means that the neoliberal capitalism as envisioned currently is by definition the victor, and thus like it was basically unquestioned until, as you mentioned, 2008.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's important to remember that capitalism won, that we used to live in a world, I mean, I was young, I don't remember it personally, but we used to live in a world where there was a sense of an alternative, that an alternative could exist. The existence of the USSR, for example, bore witness, was a testament to the fact that there could be some alternative way of running human affairs, of running human society. Even if it was degenerated and authoritarian, the simple fact that it existed had an important weight in people's minds, the way that they looked at the world. As of then, you know, there was this brief moment maybe in the early 90s when people were hopeful that the end of the Soviet Union could actually birth a new era of freedom, which then people became disappointed with pretty quickly. But I guess in the period of George H.W. Bush, you know, capitalism was triumphant and they were pretty excited about it. And they were self-confident going, we're going to implement shock therapy in Russia and we're going to, you know, make the world kind of safe for capitalism around the world. Over the next decades, they start losing a bit of confidence. And that confidence then is shattered by the time 2016 comes around. And we say that the end of history begins, if that's not too complicated a way to put it. But the end of history begins really with Trump and with Brexit, because those are, you know, the the core nerve centers of global capitalism, and they're shaken by something that wasn't meant to happen. It was two moments, both in Trump and Brexit, in they're very different ways, saying that the what we expected about globalization was now subject to political decision. It's worth remembering Tony Blair, who's like this great figure of left neoliberal politics, said that globalization is a force of nature, not a policy choice. It is a fact. Right. And that basically sums up the whole mode of end of history politics. There are no choices. These things like globalization, like free trade, they're just impositions. They're facts of nature. They're forces of nature. And we don't really have anything to say about them. All you can do is maybe decide to increase a little bit of welfare spending to protect some people. But basically, the rules of the game are settled. And suddenly, as of 2016, that's all blown open. The rules of the game are now put into question. And that's the end of history. And that's why there's so much confusion around. It's also why, and maybe you wanted to come on to this, why elites have reacted so hysterically and mm-hmm. have been unable to comprehend, to grasp what is going on. And as a consequence, have recourse to, in the better framings, the rise of populism. But in their most kind of deranged form, and you can think maybe of someone like Rachel Maddow, you know, pursuing the kind of Russiagate conspiracy theories. I mean, it's basically elite conspiracy theories to try to explain or really avoid coming up with a sensible explanation for why society and politics is changing. It's going, hey, you know, we lost an election. It must be Russian interference. The most powerful empire in human history is, being put off its rocker by some Russian bots. You know, I mean, it's completely crazy. And yet these were supposedly very sensible, moderate, rational, centrist figures who were reaching for the most crazy conspiracy theories. And this was on both sides of the Atlantic. It's worth remembering that the same thing happened with Brexit in the UK, saying that because Britain was leaving the EU, the world would fall apart. It would lead to Nazism or fascism. British people would be starving on the streets. You know, all these sort of catastrophic scenarios, which just were ways of the elite avoiding dealing with what had happened. The fact that neoliberalism had left people seriously discontent, poorer, and with less control over their lives, less control over their government. And what we've termed this, it's something called neoliberal order breakdown syndrome, which is a way of joining together all these different hysterical responses from elites who were unable to accept, to explain, and to respond to this new political change, which they expected would never happen again, that everything would just remain the same forever.
Right. And there's so much there. One thing I wanted to touch on before we move past it was the naturalization of the neoliberal world order in like the post-1990 world, and how essentially this is how things are going to stay. This is like the natural way of being. And one manifestation of that, which I'd never considered, which you point out in your book, is how activism changed in many in the wake of this before 2008. How post-Cold War activism was individualistic, consumer oriented, and usually based on like changing one's consumption choices, which I think is indicative exactly of that very dynamic. We're not focusing much on the state, because the state is natural and this is how this is supposed to be. We were triumphant in the Cold War and this is like going to be the dominant hegemonic way of being. The only way that we can express our discontent is in these very narrow lanes that doesn't necessarily, I don't know, do anything structural.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, we tried, especially in the introduction, to sort of characterize what the end of history felt like, especially for younger readers who maybe don't have a recollection of what the 90s and 2000s were. I kind of came of age in the 2000s and remembered complaining with friends that, man, there's no politics. You know, there's no real serious political contestation over what society should look like. At best, there were just kind of cultural, or maybe I should say subcultural, attempt to kind of create out a little space, a little kind of alternative culture. And this was really just the sort of tail end of the 60s counterculture, kind of in its most degenerated form. Very individualistic, based around shopping. Even if it was being against shopping, you know, in the kind of, if you think of some elements of the anti-globalization movement, being against advertising, for example, like Adbusters magazine and stuff like that. All it really said was, we accept that society is the way it is, and we just want to kind of recoil and create our own little private space around it. even in its better moments, politics around then was, and left-wing oppositional politics, well, didn't really hold any serious belief that the world could be changed. So if we think of first the anti-globalization movement and then opposition to the war on terror, the war in Iraq, it was often, I think, betrayed a kind of disbelief that anything could really change. You know, that I don't remember what it was in the US, but in the UK, the slogan was "not in our name," which kind of seems to suggest you're going to do the war anyway, but just we're bowing out. We're not giving you license to do it, which again doesn't really suggest any seriousness about taking state power or even necessarily winning elections. And so that was the dominant mode of left-wing politics until even after the global financial crisis. Because what happens then is that suddenly you have a return of politics, very little baby steps, not a big deal, but Occupy already signaled that something was changing. Because before, if throughout the 2000s, a lot of left-wing politics was minoritarian. It sought to speak in favor of, you know, defending minorities, disadvantaged, small groups of people, those the excluded, rather than speaking the name of the majority. Occupy, for all its faults, at least said, hey, we're here in favor of the 99% against the 1%. And that already signaled what would be what we see kind of as the essence of politics, which is division, right? Against the old consensus politics that dominated the 90s and 2000s, suddenly there was division. Dissensus, the idea that, you know, we have conflicting interests, which seems kind of basic, but was an important sort of development then. The problem is that things like Occupy and a whole range of kind of what they called Facebook protests at the time, and you can think of, the Arab Spring in the Middle East, occupations of squares in Italy, or rather Spain and Greece, all of these were what's been called horizontalist, right? This idea that of leaderless politics, of spontaneous uprisings, where everybody just comes in the streets and gets together and somehow progress will ensue from this, right? Just by denouncing the establishment, denouncing the elite. And that's a real problem. And that's something that we're still stuck with. So suddenly there are people on the streets. Suddenly there's big protests. Suddenly there's a complete delegitimization of the establishment and what they believe to be true, whether it's neoliberalism, whether it's technocratic modes of managing politics. No one believes in that anymore. But at the same time, we don't have the tools, the intellectual resources to think through how to do politics again. We've forgotten kind of what politics was. And that's what I'm kind of we're sort of getting at in the book, that we live in this moment of great confusion, that politics has seemed to return, but we lack the kind of resources to really try to understand what is unique about our moment, and that we can't just rely on the old forms that we inherited from the past.
Right. And another great point in that vein that is a part of a dynamic that we're all too familiar with here at the Majority Report is the concept of anti-politics. They're all corrupt, right? Yeah. Everybody is too corrupt and engaging, is not worth your time. And here's this alternative method. Again, like we fight this with people in leftist YouTube spaces who I think are actively getting people to think stupidly about politics and disengaging, encouraging them to disengage from the process outside of just vitriolic nihilism and anger expressed on Twitter. And that's it seems like a myopic conversation, but I think it is a part of this exact malaise that is this like mass nihilism and inability to comprehend how things can be changed because it seems so insurmountable, as you mentioned.
Yeah, I mean, so this idea of anti-politics, which is, I mean, just to define it, it's a mood of rejection of the political establishment, but it goes further than that because it really signals a rejection of leadership, of representation itself, and therefore it kind of is self-defeating. So this rejection, as I said, these mass movements and so on, big protests signal the return of politics, but the way that they try to like make their politics happen is that, why is this? And if you allow me just to kind of go back, way back in history, popular disgruntlement and anger with the way that the world is run was usually channeled, I mean, since, let's say, 1848, really, to the left, to socialism, that there was this idea to rally behind, right? But revolutionary socialism in many cases. We now live in a world after the fall of the Berlin Wall of the historic defeat of the working class and the end of socialism. you have a period where, let's just say, nothing really happens, or at least nothing kind of left wing really happens for 30 years. Suddenly you have this return of politics, but politics returns in the absence of a real cohering idea to get behind, whether that's a kind of more reformist socialism or revolutionary socialism. And so as a consequence, people's anger gets kind of splattered out in all sorts of different directions and really ends up being nothing more than a rejection of the establishment with nothing to put it in its place. So you can be like, let's reject the establishment. They're all corrupt. But usually that meant assuming a sort of revolutionary socialist position, right? That you're going to take power in the name of an idea with your party, with a mass movement, whatever it might be. Now it's like the same thing, except without all that stuff about parties and movements and socialism, right? So as a consequence, there's nothing to put in its place. And this sort of anti-politics is something that we kind of cover this in the book. You know, it's everywhere from South Africa to Nigeria to Slovakia to Thailand to Brazil, which we spend a bit time talking about, especially in places like Italy, but also in the UK and US. They all take different forms, but what kind of unites them is this idea, this denunciation of the ruling class as corrupt, but without any notion of what to replace it. Just one final thing on this is that that idea of them all being corrupt, that all leaders are corrupt, that any form of representation of interest is corrupt, undermines the left itself, because it means that your own leaders of your own organizations are going to be corrupt. People just say, no, I don't want to be part of that because nothing can truly represent how I feel about politics what I believe about the world or what I think should happen. And that's why it's such a dangerous double-edged sword, because it seems like a sharp sword on one side that's going to cut the heads off of the ruling class, of the elite. On the other hand, it also kind of ends up cutting off the heads of the left itself.
Yeah, and there's this dynamic you flesh out in the book about like the authoritarian right that made me think of this a little bit. How there is this impulse that I think is very dangerous by some in elite circles as well, or people who are analyzing politics, to then show deference to, say, non-elected representatives, and that can, like the military leadership, for example, and heralding them as somehow purer than the corrupt representatives of who are elected. And there's a mass amount of corruption, say, in the United States and in other governments as well, of course. But that trends towards right-wing authoritarianism. It provides a simple solution, which I think feeds into some of these narratives that you talk about in your book, how like there's these now this concept of scarcity and of scarce resources being taken from outside scary people. It's like a way for right-wingers to funnel the generalized anxiety about climate change into nationalist white supremacist narratives. Nobody does this better than Tucker Carlson, obviously, but he's kind of ahead of the curve on this, because this seems to be where things are going. A rejection of politics, it's not something the left should engage in because of these very scary consequences that I just mentioned.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, obviously we're not making the argument necessarily that left-wing people should believe in whatever kind of milquetoast center-left social democrat that's there. I mean, that's not the argument we're making. We're making an argument for taking politics seriously, and whatever the form of politics may be, it's that fundamentally relies on trusting the masses and on democratic legitimacy. And so the examples that you've just given there of kind of relying on judges to, basically curtail politicians' autonomy because they might be corrupt, or the military or whatever, is something that's really recurrent in all these cases, because that sort of delegitimization that the whole elite, the whole establishment has suffered, ends up with people looking for some saviors in various different places. And ultimately, maybe this is going to be a bit corny, but the savior is us, right? I mean, it's the masses, and we have to trust ourselves collectively. Maybe, can I just talk about Brazil quickly, if I won't lose your listeners?
Oh, 100%. This is a very, this would, Michael would love this. Yes, continue.
I remember speaking with him about Brazil quite a lot. So we use the example of Brazil because it kind of crystallizes so many of these tendencies. And so maybe you're not familiar with the specific history of the past 8 years in Brazil. But what happened in 2013 was that you had this mass uprising, which was on the one level, a rejection of the political class, but really was demanding better healthcare, better education, also sort of an end to corruption and so on. But it was kind of, let's say, democratic, social democratic in its nucleus, right? But very soon after, you found on protests that they were banning any insignia of political parties, right? There's like no parties. We are just Brazilians here. There's no divisions amongst us, any party, no red flags, no red banners, right? No color red, no socialism. We're all Brazilian here, wearing the green and gold of the national colors. And that ends up leading at the end, I mean, to kind of spoiler alert here, to Bolsonaro being elected in 2018. But what happens in that interim period is that the kind of political demands, rejecting the political establishment, but demanding an improvement in social services, for example, actually led to a very narrow anti-corruption demand, or very narrow focus on the whole political establishment being corrupt. Now, where does that lead? What are the options that are presented there if the whole political establishment is corrupt, but you're not arguing for revolutionary transformation of society? Where that ends up is in two places. One, sort of technocratic, anti-democratic, technocratic sort of ideas where, for example, you put judges in charge, and so judges are able to stop politicians acting on the popular will because whatever, corruption, right? And that's something that happened in Brazil because you had basically the judges taking Lula out of the political game. So instead of it being up to the people whether to elect Lula, who had these corruption charges against him, it was up to the judges to decide who should and shouldn't be in the political game. So that's the sort of technocratic, or what we call post-political, kind of consequence of this anti-corruption politics. The other one is an authoritarian one, where basically all of democracy is seen as suspect, and that democratic institutions, the whole process of representation, will only breed corruption because maybe the people aren't to be trusted, right? You know, there's corrupt politicians. Who elects them? Well, it's the people. Therefore, it's the people's fault. And therefore, you need a kind of an authoritarian strongman to come in and clean things up, supposedly because now this guy who's not accountable at all will somehow be able to clean things up. Of course, you know, we can obviously laugh at that idea and say it's nonsense, but that is genuinely the sort of logical consequence of this sort of anti-corruption politics, or as we call it, anti-politics.
Right. And Brazil is obviously important because you can see what can be as well, right? There's a vision for how leftist leaders can win and can be incredibly effective. So you can see both extremes, honestly, of the dynamics that you lay out in the book here.
Yeah. Though I think there's maybe some miscomprehension, I guess, outside of Brazil and indeed within Brazil, of what the sort of left under the Workers' Party represented. Because the left under the Workers' Party ruled during the period of high neoliberalism, right, throughout the 2000s. And so although it seemed like an alternative and certainly was preferable to whatever the Brazilian right had to offer, it still worked within a very circumscribed, limited frame of what was politically possible. And that basically is what we call post-politics, right? This way of effectively depoliticizing politics, of removing important decisions from contestation. So what happened throughout the Workers' Party period in power is that the its own base was demobilized. It became lots of kind of activists and union leaders were integrated into the state, managing pension plans and so on. And as a consequence, the popular energy that the PT used to be able to channel became sort of neutered and watered down. And so that was itself, you know, the form of kind of neoliberal managerial politics that existed in Brazil in the 2000s just happened to be a left-wing form of that. So we're not necessarily arguing in favor of that, even if it's a preferable option by far compared to what we've got now in Brazil. I think we should be wary of the kind of left-wing version of this sort of consensus politics, the sort of politics that ruled throughout the end of history. We should kind of grasp the nettle and demand more.
Are you hopeful about an era of remobilization?
I mean, if we're talking kind of globally or let's say across the West, I think that's possible. I think the sort of delegitimation of political establishments that we're seeing over the past 5 years is very important. Now, I guess two worries about this are two very serious roadblocks. One is that COVID has led to a sort of reestablishment of technocratic authority, right? Let's give it to Dr. Fauci to decide what to do, right, in the American case. And you find various other examples of this across the West. So that's a worry, and it's led to a kind of neoliberal resumption. And you can see something like Biden, for example, where Biden, in my view, is basically doing Trumpism, but doing it, you know, in a kind of nicer, more technocratic, shiny way, but basically implementing Trumpism. And that's a way... That's a way of what we've called also, or, you know, techno-populism, which is kind of a mixture of the kind of end of history technocracy and the with a little bit of doses of populism to kind of throw to the masses. Right. So that's one worry. That's one worry that COVID has led to a sort of dampening down of these whole range of mass protests. If you cast your mind back to 2019, you know, the before times, there were protests everywhere all around the world, in Europe, in South America, in the Middle East. And so we have to see where that evolves. The other thing and the other concern is this this revenge of the culture wars. So what we're seeing now, especially in the US, but increasingly kind of US influenced culture wars across Western Europe as well, that are different from the old form of culture wars. You know, the 80s and 90s culture war in the US were around hot button moral issues around abortion and the death penalty and things like that. Now they seem more political because they're about questions like immigration or indeed COVID, right? But the form that they take is a kind of culture war form. It's based on a cultural polarization, based on fighting over symbols, symbols that often don't have a kind of real political reference. So it's about whether you use a mask or not, which isn't really saying about how the pandemic response should be managed, whether the state should have a right to lock down society or not, whether it's a state responsibility to provide healthcare or not. All these big political questions get kind of smoothed over by this really kind of facile and kind of phony polarization around, you know, whether you wear a mask or not. And so that's another danger, that these new culture wars ends up sucking all the political energy out of the room and being diverted towards this polarization, this cultural polarization, which actually suits the elites pretty well, because, you know, people can carry on squabbling and arguing on social media and nothing really changes.
Well, then, I mean, it's also, I think, important to bring up some of the critical race theory stuff that we're seeing on the right here in the United States, because that's a I think, a part of a tried and true tactic by the right. The critical race theory is very similar to a lot of the things that we've seen in the right wing in general, but that's like I think the fact that it's tied into the pandemic speaks to just like a larger anxiety that I haven't been able to fully put my finger on yet, because, you know, I want to ask you a little bit about this too, about how things are going to shift post pandemic. It seems like this is a bit of not a reversal, but a way for the right to kind of like culturally encase themselves and have a sense of agency that's a bit different than what we've seen before.
Yeah, I mean, one thing I would say is that, and I think the left tries to avoid this conclusion, but the left won, at least the cultural left won. Now, that's not something that I would necessarily associate with in terms of I guess what you could call sort of cultural liberalism, which I don't think is the same as, you know, Marxism or socialism, for instance. And so that is fully represented across most leading mainstream institutions. And so the right have lost and are therefore, I think you're right, kind of encasing themselves and trying to create their own kind of bubbles of safety, which aren't subject to the forms of, well, I guess what you could call rationalization, but the sort of hegemony of cultural liberalism. And so I think if we ignore that aspect and they ignore that aspect that the cultural left actually won, it was successful, we kind of misunderstand what's going on. And we often tend to say, well, you know, this is the return of some old right wing nasty ideas which are going to come and win. And it's the kind of fascist revival or whatever, right? I think it's important to understand that the right is actually very weak. It's very weak today. It doesn't have a lot of popular purchase. What it is able to do, I mean, it certainly is, we're talking about the sort of populist right, not the mainstream institutional right, is that it's able to funnel a lot of disgruntlement and a lot of kind of rebellious energy. Because if you're thinking like, you might not have any, let's say, connection to the left, but you hate what's been going on. You hate the fact that, for example, the lockdowns have prevented you from working or even just seeing your friends and things like this. And you think that that might be wrong. You know, where are you going to go? The left is basically saying, hey, do as you're told, follow the rules, without asking any serious questions about the way the pandemic has been managed, for instance, then the right's going to be the place you go, you know, that the rebellious energy is all on the right. And I think that's a very dangerous place for the left to then find itself in, to find itself in the position of being the, or, you know, or of always trying to be sort of the adults in the room. And it's weird because it's, we were talking a little bit about the kind of culture, the sort of alt culture of the 90s and stuff. You know, you talked about Jackass and whatever. Yeah. That sort of like Gen X style of politics was all about saying, you know, like putting like middle finger up at authority and whatever, which I'm not defending at all, right? I think that's a really limited form of politics. I think what I've said should make that obvious. But we've kind of gone full circle here, or, you know, gone 180, where the left is now going, you know, respect the authority of the technocratic administrators and follow the rules and so on. That's not a good good look for the left.
Yeah, I no, but at the same time, I mean, I understand the compulsion in the middle of a pandemic to trust the person that knows what they're talking about.
No, right? Absolutely. Though, you know, I think we have to ask serious questions about scientists, because I think, yes, we should respect scientific authority, and I think it's very important to defend science as a process of open-ended discovery. But to just defend the authority of specific technocrats effectively is problematic, because they have their own politics that they bring. It's not just purely technical expertise that is at play there. Ultimately, these things are always political decisions. So you might say that, for example, lockdowns might help prevent the spread, but then you have to balance that against other issues. For example, the fact that people haven't been able to get healthcare for other serious conditions. I'm not trying to get into discussion specifically about the pandemic. All right. I'm trying to illustrate is the importance of politics and not trying to, and the left should most of all not try to suck politics out of what should be political decisions and say, this is just a technical issue. We should do as the experts say. These things should always be put into question.
Right. Outsourcing inherently political decisions to non-elected officials is not a good, I think, like, mode for the left to fall into.
Absolutely. Yeah.
It's an understandable impulse and even a helpful one, at least to defer to, say, the CDC in the middle of a pandemic, but deferring to specific officials that are unelected is like probably not the best.
Well, and don't put the CDC in charge of evictions if you can stop evictions and with
right.
Your
right exactly. So I guess the I'll end with you here. Do you see a second end or a third end or a new shift or a rebirth or whatever after the pandemic? Because like a lot of this is depressing, but there are glimmers of hope, as you mentioned, post 2008. It's just how is that captured?
Yeah, I mean, I would say don't panic. Things are a lot worse than you think they are. I mean, we are in a historical nadir in terms of what is possible. At the same time, the fact that things are falling apart does open up a glimmer of possibility. And if I would say one thing, it's that we should be wary of the fact that there's a whole lot of forces which are trying to put politics back in the box, to depoliticize things or to allow them to be politicized only in kind of culture wars sort of framing. And so we should be open to new forms of rebellion and things that might not look like what we want them to look like, right? If we're kind of like left-wing people or activists or intellectuals going, looking at things and going, well, this doesn't sound like the stuff that I expected it to be. Well, we're in very different terrain. The 20th century is now long over. And so to expect things to look like that would be a real sort of category error. So we should be open to things. And if things look like too populist, too right wing, maybe we should think twice about what is actually behind that, because things will take various different forms today and they're not set in stone. And we should be kind of open to the possibilities that that kind of new forms of rebellion or dissent are things that can actually be good for the left and that can lead us to break with this kind of historical deadlock that we're currently in.
Alex Hokuli, author of The End of History, Politics in the 21st Century. Alex, thanks so much for your time today. Great discussion. I really appreciate
it. Thank you. Cheers.
All right, folks, taking a quick break, and we will be right back and wrap up some things. We are back. And in case you've been living under a rock, well, maybe not even. In case you aren't tapped into what a lot of the like centrist types in the media and in DC are saying about the protesters who had the gall to ask their senator to represent them. There's a lot of pearl clutching about this, and even Cory Booker signed a letter condemning the actions of harassing the esteemed Sinema, Senator Sinema. And yet, we're not seeing the same outrage about just regular people getting harassed, because the powers that be are fine with divorcing the content of what is being protested from the form. And that serves power, by the way, even though...
Because this popular mobilization is, as we just discussed with Hockley, important for the right wing and an opportunity for them. And that's how they see it. So we're going to analyze one.
Yeah. Here is one of those instances of anti-mass demonstrators in Beverly Hills, California.
Beverly Hills, interesting. This is just to note where this message is being received at. This is Beverly Hills. This is actually the same protester who was yelled at by the homeless guy in the clip we played yesterday, where she asked, why don't you see all the homeless dead in the streets? And he says, because I'm vaccinated. I won't say.
Yeah, she called her and called her dumb bleep. But basically, the same woman who's clearly been busy decided it's time to berate parents and their children and accuse them of abuse. Where did she get that from? Let's take a listen.
He's going to be traumatized because you put that mask on him. You don't let him breathe through it. You're traumatizing
That's my choice.
Yeah, well,
that's my choice. Yeah, you better respect my choice, too.
No. You're propagandized. You're not being told the truth. You're scaring your kid by yelling.
You're propagandized. That's interesting.
That is insanely infuriating. And I know I'm not a parent, because my first reaction to that is, how are all those anti-vax people walking away with all their teeth? But I realize you can't just sock people when you're walking your child home from school. But I mean, getting in their face, that is child abuse right there. Like, that is a very traumatizing experience for those kids to have
some random woman accuse your parent of abusing you.
Yeah. Exactly. Like, right. I mean, the idea that they care about child abuse is instead of enforcing this sort of culture war totem that masks are subservience, which, exactly. I wonder where we got that idea from. I wonder where that idea entered the zeitgeist.
Roll the clip.
So the next time you see someone in a mask on the sidewalk or on the bike path, do not hesitate. Ask politely but firmly, would you please take off your mask? Science shows there is no reason for you to be wearing it. Your mask is making me uncomfortable. We should do that, and we should keep doing it until wearing a mask outside is roughly as socially accepted as lighting a Marlboro in an elevator. It's repulsive. Don't do it around other people. That's the message we should send, because it's true. As for forcing children to wear masks outside, that should be illegal. Your response when you see children wearing masks as they play should be no different from your response to seeing someone beat a kid in Walmart. Call the police immediately. Contact Child Protective Services. Keep calling until someone arrives. What you're looking at is abuse. It's child abuse, and you are morally obligated to attempt to prevent it.
Huh.
Leads directly into the Beverly Hills homes of these reactionaries, and they go out and take it as marching orders to abuse other people's kids.
And you know what, too? Understand that this is a part of Tucker Carlson's project. He sees this constituency as someone new to tap into, as a new area in which he can radicalize people to the right wing.
Yes, because it's not, you can't do that. You can't attract people by saying tax cuts and don't do any spending and all this pro boss, pro corporate stuff. So you have to. Oh, a basketball player wants special treatment from a municipal vax mandate. Okay, that's something I can talk about, because they can't. All this propaganda is designed to conceal that they are for the bosses.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And again, I think it also is just like, there has always been this anti-vax contingent that percolates throughout the country. And it's, of course, grown exponentially during the pandemic. And Tucker Carlson saw this group of people who are inherently mistrustful of authority, of science, who have these proclivities, and said, okay, maybe they aren't necessarily right-wing now, but I have the ability to turn them over and convert them in many ways. And they may not even define themselves as right-wingers at this point. But once you're participating in these spaces, and once you get in these spaces, it's inevitable. And Tucker Carlson understands that. He's been at the forefront of a variety of these very scary conversion projects and influence projects. This is why he sees something in somebody like Jimmy Dore, and he sees something in somebody like Andrew Yang, who we'll talk about in the second hour of the program. These are useful little factions that he thinks are going to be helpful in order to complete this, you know, white supremacist takeover that he's envisioning. He may not say it like that, but that's what it is.
Yeah, well, I mean, he does say he has a cultural problem with immigrants.
Immigration, so, yeah, he all but says it.
Yeah, I mean, this is the project, and it is notable that all these people are crying crocodile tears for Kyrsten Sinema, and we had to take it like it was such a big worrying thing when the guy got in Tucker's face at a Montana, like, bait shop. But meanwhile, this is a direct consequence of Tucker Carlson's actions, and we won't hear anything from it. From the people who, even if they didn't think that what Sinema, like the Tucker guests, who might not think that what happened to Sinema was bad because they can't take that sort of elite protecting take, but they think that it's hypocritical. So the thing to point out is the hypocrisy. I think it's weird if all you ever point out is hypocrisy.
Yeah.
For instance, like the border, like, look at this hypocrisy. Don't you want to go a little bit further and say something about Title 42, or is it just about the liberal hypocrisy for you?
Yeah, right. Well, I mean, hard to cash in on liberal cultural agreement when you're trying to talk, when you're talking about politics. That's going to get in the way of that. Making a substantive point about policy. Anyway, all right, folks, Peacock folks, that's all the time that we have. Enjoy your Peacocktober. Jesus. See you tomorrow. I've been seeing those Peacocktober ads. And so
wait,
I want
those are real ads?
Yes.
Oh, well, okay. I thought you made that up.
But... nope. I'm not that brilliant. All right, folks, we are going to head into the fun half where we will talk about a variety of things, including Andrew Yang's appearance on Tucker Carlson's program. But first, do we have Brandon and Matt?
We have one of them at this point. Maybe Matt will join us a little bit. Let me widen the screen.
Brandon.
Brandon will be joining us in a little bit. In the meantime,
Left Reckoning.
We had a long show. We went long in the first half with Cale Brooks talking about kind of similar topic, actually, to this. Is the left losing sort of working class and different sort of conversations around, for instance, the German example? We also talked about Sinema and how Crowder and Rubin both came to her defense. Mm. Which is interesting. Crowder came to her defense with racism. Rubin came to her defense. You know, this is just another case of the lefties just going crazy. I think taking a break from
crazy, man,
trying to make Ashley Babbitt a martyr. But yeah, we talked about that. We also talked about Dave Rubin again in the post game about where we sort of align and disalign, unalign with Dave and the right on this whole regulating the tech companies thing. It's interesting. But anyway, I don't want to get too deep into that. Patreon.com/LeftReckoning to get the post game, but go subscribe to the YouTube channel.
Brandon, how are you?
I'm doing all right, Emma. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. Is I can't even see from here without my glasses. That Dragon Ball Z shirt.
Wow. Wow. Okay. Well, I'm going to ignore that. How are you doing, Emma? But despite you know, disrespecting my people, and by that I mean anime fans.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I only know of Attack on Titan because my boyfriend likes it, but it seemed a little too scary for me, so I didn't watch it.
Hold on. It's actually Kimetsu no Yaiba, Demon Slayer. It's a Demon Slayer shirt, and this is
okay. I'll just blame it on not wearing my glasses. What's happening over on the discourse?
Actually, you know, the reason why I was a little bit tardy is because I was setting up, as I promised 2 months ago, my streaming capabilities, so I can display some high-level Slay the Spire play for all the fans. So be excited, be thrilled, you know, I'm gonna get that camera and mic working, and we're going to have a lot of fun.
Oh,
wow. Is it a Twitch thing?
I don't know. However it streams out to people. I'm not really good with internet stuff. So, you know, it'll be Twitch or YouTube, but everyone isn't going to, like, you know, literally censor me for my ideas.
Right. Well, that's nobody. Rockfin.
Rumble. Do we have Matt?
Hello.
Whoa, just like that. How you doing, Matt?
I'm all right. How are you guys doing?
We're doing well. What's happening over on Doomed?
There'll be a show, youtube.com/MattBender. Tune in.
There will be a show.
There will be a show.
Oh, well, that's a
Daniel Day-Lewis of you.
Yeah, right.
There you go. Yeah.
Okay.
Actually, what I should probably do is I should probably get on Twitch after seeing how much money all those Twitch streamers are making. I gotta get in on that. If you've seen those Twitch hack details.
You're already on Twitch, aren't you?
Yeah, but I'm not a partner because I do the dual stream thing with YouTube and Twitch. And YouTube demonetized.
They don't actually care. Left Reckoning.
They don't actually care? Really?
You know, we avoided that. Maybe I'm gonna get everybody in trouble, but Left Reckoning, we avoided doing that until we decided just to do it and nobody's cared. But I only need a Twitch because we have rated you a few times, but the only problem is our Twitch is we only get like 20 viewers at a time. We like you, we kind of give more love to YouTube, which may be a strategic error.
Watch Left Reckoning at the same time on Twitch and on YouTube.
I want to be clear that this is not a money-making scheme for me on going on Twitch. I personally just have to do it for the mea culpas, for the many broken promises to my fans. So, you know, it's more about, like, my deficiencies than any of my aspirations.
Well, be sure to forward me like any money you make from Twitch if you don't want it.
Same here. 646-257-3920. We're going to head into the fun half. Check out Just Coffee. Free trade coffee, chocolate, and tea. I did that okay there. And we will be taking your IMs. We will be taking your calls. We will be laughing, hopefully. Hopefully not crying, though. See you in the fun half.
Left is best.
Jamie and I may have a disagreement.
Yeah, you can't just say whatever you want about people just because you're rich.
I have an absolute right to mock them on YouTube.
He's up there buggy whipping like he's the boss.
I am not your employer.
You know, I'm tired of the negativity.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to upset you. You're nervous, you're a little bit upset, you're riled up.
Yeah, maybe you should rethink your defense of that, you fucking idiots.
We're just going to get rid of you.
All right.
But dude.
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 You want to smoke this joint?
Yes.
Do you feel like you are a dinosaur?
Some good shit.
Exactly. I'm happy now.
It's a win-win.
It's a win-win-win.
Oh, hell yeah.
Now listen to me. 2, 3, 4, 5 times. 847-906-501-457. 2, 38, 56, 27. 1/2, 5/8. 3.9 billion.
Wow.
He's the ultimate math nerd.
Don't you see?
Why don't you get a real job instead of spewing vitriol and hatred, you left-wing Limbaugh?
Everybody's taking their dumb juice today.
Come on, Sammy.
Dance, dance, dance.
Ooh. Grandpa.
I had my first post-coital scene with a woman. I'm hoping to add more moves to my repertoire. All I have is the dip and the swirl.
Fine, we can double dip.
Yes, this is a perfect moment.
No.
Wait, what?
You make under $1 million a year. You're scum. You're nothing.
Excuse me? Fuck you, you fucking liberal elite. I think you belong in jail.
Thank you for saying that, Sam. You're a horrible, despicable person.
All right, gonna take a quick break. I want to take a moment to talk to some of the libertarians out there. Take whatever vehicle you want to drive to the library. What you're talking about is jibber jabs.
Classic. I'm feeling more chill already.
Good.
Donald Trump can kiss all of our asses.
Hey, Sam. Hey, Andy. Are you guys ready to do some evil?
Hitler was such an idiot.
That guy might be a Nazi.
Agree.
No.
Death to America.
You.
Yes.
Wow.
Wow, that's weird.
No way!
Unbelievable. This guy's got a really good hook.
Throw our hands up.
Ooh.
Wow.
But Sam, I gotta get off.
No worries. Let's I wanna just flesh this out a little bit. I mean, look, it's a free speech issue. If you don't like me.
Hey, shut up!
Thank you for calling into the Majority Report. Sam will be with you shortly.